The following is a quote from Baron de Montesquieu. A really intelligent man feels what other men only know.
Chapter 8. Respect the process. Mastery. The fools in life want things fast and easy. Money, success, attention. Boredom is their great enemy and fear. Whatever they manage to get slips through their hands as fast as it comes in. You, on the other hand, want to outlast your rivals. You are building the foundation for something that can continue to expand. To make this happen, you will have to serve an apprenticeship. You must learn early on to endure the hours of practice and drudgery, knowing that in the end, all of that time will translate into a higher pleasure. Mastery of a craft and of yourself. Your goal is to reach the ultimate skill level, an intuitive feel for what must come next.
Slow money. The following is a quote from Charlie Parker. Master the instrument, master the music, then forget all that shit and play. Growing up in Southside, Queens, the only people Curtis Jackson could see who had any money and power were the street hustlers. So at the age of 11, and with big dreams for the future, he chose just such a path for himself. Almost immediately, however, he saw that the life of a hustler was not glamorous at all. It consisted mostly of standing on a street corner day after day, selling the same stuff to the same fiends. It meant enduring hours with nothing to do, waiting for customers to come by, often in the bitter cold or the blistering heat. And in those long, tedious hours on the streets, Curtis's mind naturally would wander. He would find himself wishing for money that would come faster and easier, with more excitement. There were opportunities for this in the hood. They mostly involved crime or some dubious scheme. Sometimes he would feel tempted to try them, but in such moments he would remind himself of the endless stories of the hustlers he had known who had fallen for the illusion of fast, easy money. All suckers who inevitably ended up dead or broke. There was his friend T.C., who got tired of hustling and fell in with a crew that would spend the summer robbing convenience stores and occasionally a bank. He made quite a haul of money over those 3 months and then blew it all over the fall and winter. The following summer, he was back at it again. It wasn't just the money. It was the thrill that came in flirting with so much danger. But that second summer, his luck ran out, and he was killed in a gunfight with the police. There was Curtis's colleague, Spite, a few years older, who had managed to save some money from his hustling, but had dreams of something much bigger. He convinced himself he could make a fortune fast by buying a piece of a franchise business that was new to the hood, but that he felt was certain to be hot. He poured all of his money into the venture, but he was too impatient. He had not taken the time to accustom the public to his new life. Everyone believed the business was just a front for some drug operation. They avoided it, and it soon became a hangout for hustlers and fiends. It failed within a few months, and he never recovered from the experience. This was the gist of the problem. To be a successful hustler, you had to accustom yourself to the slow, grinding pace of the job. But in the hood, the future rarely seemed promising. It was hard for hustlers to imagine saving their money for some rainy day in the future, when that day would probably never come. Inevitably, the desire for something faster would creep into their blood. And if they gave in, they created a cycle they could never escape. If they were able to get some fast money, it would act like a drug. They would get excited and spend it all on items to impress people. With no money left, they would return to dealing drugs, but now it seemed too slow and boring. They would try again for something fast. They became trapped by their own greed, and as the years went by, they would fail to develop any kind of patience or discipline. They could not manage this up-and-down pace for too long. By the age of 25 or 30, they would burn themselves out and have no skills or money to show for their years of work. Their fate after that was generally unpleasant. To resist this temptation, Curtis decided he would force himself in the opposite direction. He treated hustling as a job. He showed up on the street corner at the same hour every day, working from dawn to dusk. Gradually, he accustomed himself to this slow pace. During the long hours with nothing to do, he would contemplate the future and come up with detailed plans of what he would accomplish year by year, ending with his eventual escape from street hustling. He would move into music and then into business. To take the first step, he would have to save his money. The thought of this goal helped him endure the daily tedium of the job. In these slow hours, he also devised new hustling schemes with the idea of continually improving himself at this job. He took up boxing to discipline his mind and body. He was terrible at first, but he was tenacious, training day in and day out, eventually becoming a skilled fighter. This taught him invaluable lessons. He could get whatever he wanted through sheer persistence rather than by violence or force. Progressing step by step was the only way to succeed in anything. By the age of 20, he made his break into music, all according to his original plan. In 1999, after a few years of apprenticing with Jam Master Jay, Curtis, now known as 50 Cent, signed a deal with Columbia Records. It seemed like a dream come true, but as he looked around at the other rappers who had been at the label a little longer, he saw the dangers around him had only increased. The tendency, as he saw it, was to immediately let up in your energy and focus. Rappers would feel that they had arrived, and unconsciously they wouldn't work as hard and would spend less time learning their craft. That sudden influx of money would go to their heads. They would imagine that they had the golden touch and could keep it coming. One hit song or record would make this even worse. Not building something slowly, a career, a future, it would all fall apart within a few years as younger and more eager rappers would take their place. Their life would be all the more miserable for having once tasted some glory. To Curtis, the solution was simple. This was a new world he had entered. He had to take his time and learn it well. In the fast environment of hip-hop, he would slow everything down. He avoided the partying and kept mostly to himself. He decided to treat Columbia Records as a university, his one chance to educate himself in the business. He would record his music at night and spend the entire day at the Columbia offices, talking shop to people in every division. Gradually, he taught himself more and more about marketing and distribution and the nuts and bolts of the business. He studied all aspects of production, what went into making a hit song. He practiced his music over and over. When the label sent him and dozens of other rappers to a retreat in upstate New York to write songs, he returned with 36 tracks, while most of the others could barely muster 5 or 6. In the wake of the assassination attempt on 50 in 2000, Columbia Records dropped him from the label, but by then he had outgrown his need for their expertise. He had accumulated so much knowledge and skill that he was able to apply it all to his mixtape campaign, creating songs at an insane pace and marketing his music as smartly as any professional. Step by step he advanced, the campaign gaining the attention of Eminem, who signed him to his label at Interscope in 2003. Years later, he found himself in the corporate world, and he quickly discovered it was not much different from the streets. So many of the business people and executives he met had that same level of impatience. They could only think in terms of months or weeks. Their relationship to money was emotional, a way to impose their importance and feed their ego. They would come to him with schemes that seemed intriguing in the present, but that led nowhere down the road. They were not attuned to the immense changes going on in the world and planning to exploit them in the future. That would take too much effort and time. These business types came at him from all directions with endorsement deals that would make him some fast millions. They assumed he was like all the other rappers who grabbed at such opportunities. But endorsement deals would not help him build anything solid or real. It was illusion money. He would turn them down, opting to start his own businesses on his own terms, each business building on the other like links on a chain. The goal this time was simple, to forge an empire that would last. And as before, he would get there through his own grinding persistence. The Fearless Approach. The following is a quote from 50 Cent. "Most people can't handle boredom. That means they can't stay on one thing until they get good at it, and they wonder why they're unhappy." For our most primitive ancestors, life was a constant struggle, entailing endless labor to secure food and shelter. If there was any free time, it generally was reserved for rituals that would give meaning to such a hard life. Then, over thousands of years of civilization, life gradually became easier for many. And with that came more and more free time. In such moments, there was no need to work the fields or worry about enemies or the elements. Just an expanse of hours to somehow fill. And suddenly, a new emotion was born into this world. Boredom. At work or in rituals, the mind would be filled with various tasks to accomplish. But alone in one's house, this free time would allow the mind to roam wherever it wanted. Confronted with such freedom, the mind has a tendency to gravitate towards anxieties about the future, possible problems and dangers. Such empty time faintly echoes the internal emptiness of death itself. And so with this new emotion that assailed our ancestors came a desire that haunts us to this day, to escape boredom at all cost, to distract ourselves from these anxieties. The principal means of distraction are all forms of public entertainment, drugs and alcohol, and social activities. But such distractions have a drug-like effect. They wear off. We crave new ones, faster ones, to lift us out of ourselves and divert us from the harsh realities of life and creeping boredom. An entire civilization, ancient Rome, practically collapsed under the weight of this new need and emotion. Their economy became tied to the creation of novel luxuries and entertainments that sapped its citizens' spirit. Few were willing anymore to sacrifice their pleasures for hard work or the public good. This is the pattern that boredom has created for the human animal ever since. We look outside ourselves for diversions and grow dependent on them. These entertainments have a faster pace than the time we spend at work. Work, then, is experienced as something boring, slow, and repetitive. Anything challenging, requiring effort, is viewed the same way. It's not fun. It's not fast. If we go far enough in this direction, we find it increasingly difficult to muster the patience to endure the hard work that is required for mastering any kind of craft. It becomes harder to spend time alone. Life becomes divided between what is necessary, time at work, and what is pleasurable, distractions and entertainment. In the past, these extremes of boredom assailed mostly those in the upper classes. Now it is something that plagues almost all of us. There is, however, another possible relationship to boredom and empty time, a fearless one that yields much different results than frustration and escapism. It goes as follows. You have some large goal that you wish to achieve in your life, something you feel that you are destined to create. If you reach that goal, it will bring you far greater satisfaction than the evanescent thrills that come from outside diversions. To get there, you will have to learn a craft, educate yourself, and develop the proper skills. All human activities involve a process of mastery. You must learn the various steps and procedures involved, proceeding to higher and higher levels of proficiency. This requires discipline and tenacity, the ability to withstand repetitive activity, slowness, and the anxiety that comes with such a challenge. Once you start down this path, two things will happen. First, having the larger goal will lift your mind out of the moment and help you endure the hard work and drudgery. Second, as you become better at this task or craft, it becomes increasingly pleasurable. You see your improvement. You see connections and possibilities you hadn't noticed before. Your mind becomes absorbed in mastering it further, and in this absorption, you forget all your problems, fears for the future, or people's nasty games. But unlike the diversion that comes from outside sources, this one comes from within. You are developing a lifelong skill, the kind of mental discipline that will serve as the foundation of your power. To make this work, you must choose a career or a craft that excites you in some deep way. You are creating no dividing line between work and pleasure. Your pleasure comes in mastering the process itself and in the mental immersion it requires. In the hood, most of the jobs that are available offer low money and the kind of menial work that leads to no real skills. Even hustling is tedious and not really a path with a future. In the face of this reality, people can go in one of two directions. They can seek to escape this reality through drugs, alcohol, gang activity, or whatever immediate pleasures can be had. Or they can get out of the cycle by developing an intense work ethic and discipline. The types who go in the latter direction have a deep hunger for power and a sense of urgency. Nipping at their heels at all times is the possibility of a life of crap jobs or dangerous distractions. They teach themselves to be patient and to practice something. They have learned from early on, through their jobs or through hustling, to endure the long, boring stretches of time that are necessary to master a process. They do not whine or seek to escape this reality, but instead see it as a means to freedom. For those of us who do not grow up in such an environment, we do not feel this urgent connection between discipline and power. Our jobs are not so dull. Someday they may lead to something really good, or so we think. We have developed some discipline at school or on the job, and it's enough. But we are, in fact, deluding ourselves. More often than not, our jobs are something that we endure. We live for our time off and dream of the future. We are not engaged in the daily activity of the job with our full mental powers because it is not as exciting as life outside work. We develop less and less tolerance for dull moments and repetitive activity. If we happen to lose our job or want something else, we suddenly have to confront the fact that we do not have the requisite patience to make the proper change. Before it is too late, we must wake up and realize that real power and success can come only through mastering a process, which in turn depends on a foundation of discipline that we are constantly keeping sharp. The fearless types in history inevitably display in their lives a higher tolerance than most of us for repetitive, boring tasks. This allows them to excel in their field and master their craft. Part of this comes from seeing early on in life the tangible results that come from such rigorousness and patience. In this vein, the story of Isaac Newton is particularly illuminating. In early 1665, he was a 23-year-old student at Cambridge University, on the verge of taking his exams to be a scholar in mathematics, when suddenly the plague broke out in London. The deaths were horrific and multiplied by the day. Many Londoners fled to the countryside where they spread the plague far and wide. By that summer, Cambridge was forced to close, and its students dispersed in all directions for their safety. For these students, nothing could have been worse. They were forced to live in scattered villages and experienced intense fear and isolation for the next 20 months as the plague raged throughout England. Their active minds had nothing to seize upon, and many went mad with boredom. For Newton, however, the plague months represented something entirely different. He returned to his mother's home in Woolsthorpe, Lincolnshire, At Cambridge, he had been bothered by a series of mathematical problems that tortured not only him but his professors as well. He decided he would spend the time in Woolsthorpe working over such problems. He had carried with him a large number of books on mathematics that he had accumulated, and he proceeded to study them in intense detail. He went over the same problems day after day, filling notebooks with endless calculations. When the sky was clear, he would wander outside and continue these musings, seated in the apple orchards surrounding the house. He would look up at an apple dangling on a branch, the same size to his eye as the moon above, and he would ponder the relationship between the two, what held the one on the tree and the other within the Earth's orbit, leading him to ideas about gravity. Staring at the sun and its optical effect on everything around him, he began to conduct his own experiments on the movement and properties of light itself. His mind flowed naturally from problems of geometry to how it all related to motion and mechanics. The deeper he went into these studies, the more he would see connections and have sudden insights. He solved problem after problem, his enthusiasm and momentum quickening as he realized the powers he was unleashing in himself. While the others were paralyzed with fear and boredom, he passed the entire 20 months without a thought of the plague or any worries for the future. And in that time, he essentially created modern mathematics, mechanics, and optics. It is generally considered the most prolific, concentrated period of scientific thinking in the history of mankind. Of course, Isaac Newton possessed a rare mind, but at Cambridge, nobody had suspected him of such mental powers. It took this period of forced isolation and repetitive labor to transform him into a genius. When we look at those who stand out in history, we tend to focus on their achievements. From such an angle, it is easy for us to be dazzled and see their success as stemming from genetics and perhaps some social factors. They are gifted. We could never reach their level, or so we think. But we are choosing to ignore that telling period in their lives, when each and every one of them underwent a rather tedious apprenticeship in their field. What kept them going was the power they quickly discovered through mastery of certain steps. Sudden insights came to them that seem like genius to us, but are actually part of any intense learning process. If only we were to study that part of their lives as opposed to the legends they later became, we would understand that we, too, could have some or all of that power by a patient immersion in any field of study. Many people cannot handle the boredom this might entail. They fear starting out on such an arduous process. They prefer their distractions, dreams, and illusions, never aware of the higher pleasures that are there for those who choose to master themselves and a craft. Keys to Fearlessness. The following is a quote from Blaise Pascal. All of man's troubles come from not knowing how to sit still, alone in a room. As children learning language, we all undergo the same process. At first, we experience a level of frustration. We have desires and needs we wish to express, but we lack the words. Slowly, we pick up phrases and absorb patterns of speech. We accumulate vocabulary, word by word. Some of this is tedious, but we are impelled by our intense curiosity and hunger for knowledge. At a certain point, we attain a level of fluency in which we can communicate as fast as we think. Soon, we don't have to think at all. Words come naturally, and at times when we are inspired, they flow out of us in ways we cannot even explain. Learning a language, our own or a foreign one, involves a process that cannot be avoided. There are no shortcuts. Learning language sets the pattern for all human activities, purely intellectual or physical. To master a musical instrument or a game, we begin at the lowest level of competence. The game seems boring as we have to learn the rules and play on a simple level. As with learning language, we feel frustrated. We see others play well, and we imagine how that could feel. But we are locked in this mode of tedious practice and repetition. At such a point, we either give in to our frustration and give up the process, or we proceed, intuiting the power that lies just around the corner. Slowly, our ability rises and the frustration lowers. We don't need to think so much. We are surprised by our fluency and connections that come to us in a flash. Once we reach a certain level of mastery, we see there are higher levels and challenges. If we are disciplined and patient, we proceed. At each higher level, new pleasures and insights await us, ones not even suspected when we started out. We can take this as far as we want. In any human activity, there is always a higher level to which we can aspire. For thousands of years, this concept of learning was an elemental part of practical wisdom. It was embedded in the concept of mastering a craft. Human survival depended on the construction of instruments, buildings, ships, and more. To build them well, a person had to learn the craft, spending years as an apprentice, advancing step by step. With the advent of the printing press and books that could be distributed widely, this discipline and patience was then applied to education, to formally gaining knowledge. Those who posed as people who possessed learning without the years of accumulating knowledge were thought of as charlatans and quacks, to be despised. Today, however, we have reached a dangerous point in which this elemental wisdom is being forgotten. Much of this is due to the destructive side of technology. We all understand its immense benefits and the power it has brought us. But with the intense speed and ease with which we can get what we want, a new pattern of thinking has evolved. We are by nature creatures of impatience. It has always been hard for us to want something and not have the capacity to get it. The increased speed from technology accentuates this childish aspect of our character. The slow accumulation of knowledge seems unnecessarily boring. Learning should be fun, fast, and easy. On the internet, we can make instant connections, skimming along the surface from one subject to the next. We come to value breadth of knowledge over depth, the power to move here or there rather than digging deeper to the source of a problem and finding out how things tick. We lose a sense of process. In such an atmosphere, charlatans sprout like weeds. They offer the age-old myth of the quick transformation, the shortcut to power, beauty, and success, in the form of books, CDs, seminars, ancient secrets brought back to life, and they find many suckers on which to prey. This new pattern of thinking and learning is not progress. It creates a phenomenon that we shall call the short circuit. To reach the end of anything, to master a process, requires time, focus, and energy. When people are so distracted, their minds constantly moving from one thing to another, it becomes increasingly difficult to maintain concentration on one thing for a few hours, let alone for months and years. Under this influence, the mind will tend to short-circuit. It will not be able to go all the way to the end of a task. It will want to move on to something else that seems more enticing. It becomes hard to make things well when the focus is broken, which is why we find a gradual increase in products that are shoddy, made with less and less attention to detail. Understand, the real secret, the real formula for power in this world, lies in accepting the ugly reality that learning requires a process, and this in turn demands patience and the ability to endure drudge work. It is not sexy or seductive at first glance, but this truth is based on something real and substantial. An age-old wisdom that will never be overturned. The key is the level of your desire. If you are really after power and mastery, then you will absorb this idea deeply and engrave it in your mind. There are no shortcuts. You will distrust anything that is fast and easy. You will be able to endure the initial months of dull, repetitive labor because you have an overall goal. This will prevent you from short-circuiting, knowing many things but mastering none of them. In the end, what you really will be doing is mastering yourself. Your impatience, your fear of boredom and empty time, your need for constant fun and amusement. The following are five principal strategies for developing the proper relationship to process. Progress through trial and error. Based on his street fighting as a teenager, Jack Johnson had the feeling that he could someday become a great boxer. But he was black and poor, too poor to afford a trainer. And so in 1896, at the age of 18, he began a rather remarkable process. He looked for any conceivable fight he could have in the ring, with any kind of opponent. In the beginning, he suffered some terrible beatings from boxers who used him as sparring material. But since this was his only form of education, he quickly learned to become as evasive as possible, to prolong the fights so he could learn. At the time, fights could go a full 20 rounds, and Johnson's goal was always to drag them out to the maximum. In that time, he would carefully study his opponents. He observed how some types would move in familiar patterns, and how others would telegraph their punches. He could categorize them by the look in their eye and their body language. He learned to provoke some into a rage so he could study their reactions. Others, he lulled to sleep with a calm style, to see the effects of this as well. Johnson's method was quite painful. It meant 15 to 20 bouts a year. He suffered innumerable hard blows. Even though he could knock out most of his opponents, he preferred to be evasive and learn on the job. This meant hearing endless taunts from the mostly white audiences that he was a coward. Slowly, however, it began to pay off. He faced such a variety of foes that he became adept at recognizing their particular style the instant the fight began. He could sense their weaknesses and when exactly he should move in for the kill. He accustomed himself, mentally and physically, to the pace of a long, grueling bout. He gained an intuitive feel for the space of the boxing ring itself and how to maneuver and exhaust his opponents over the course of 20 rounds. Many of them later confessed that he seemed to have the ability to read their minds. He was always a step ahead. Following this path, within a few short years, Johnson transformed himself into the heavyweight champion of the world and the greatest fighter of his era. Too often, our concept of learning is to absorb ideas from books, to do what others tell us to, and perhaps to do some controlled exercises. But this is an incomplete and fearful concept of learning, cut off from practical experience. We are creatures who make things. We don't simply imagine them. To master any process, you must learn through trial and error. You experiment, you take some hard blows, and you see what works and doesn't work in real time. You expose yourself and your work to public scrutiny. Your failures are embedded in your nervous system. You do not want to repeat them. Your successes are tied to immediate experience and teach you more. You come to respect the process in a deep way because you see and feel the progress you can make through practice and steady labor. Taken far enough, you gain a fingertip feel for what needs to be done because your knowledge is tied to something physical and visceral. And having such intuition is the ultimate point of mastery. Master something simple. Often we have a general feeling of insecurity because we have never really mastered anything in life. Unconsciously, we feel weak and never quite up to the task. Before we begin something, we sense we will fail. The best way to overcome this once and for all is to attack this weakness head on and build for ourselves a pattern of confidence. And this must be done by first tackling something simple and basic, giving us a taste for the power we can have. Demosthenes, one of the greatest political figures in ancient Athens, followed such a path, determined to overcome his intense fear of public speaking. As a child, he was frail and nervous. He talked with a stammer and always seemed out of breath. He was constantly ridiculed. His father had died when he was young, leaving him a nice sum of money, but his guardians quickly stole all of it. He decided to become a lawyer and eventually take the perpetrators to court on his own. But a lawyer needed to be an eloquent speaker, and he was an abysmal failure at that. He decided he would give up law. It seemed too difficult. With what little money he had, he would retire from the world and attempt somehow to master his speech impediment. At least then, he could take on some kind of public career. He built an underground study where he could practice alone. He shaved half his head so he would be too embarrassed to go out in public. To overcome his stammer, he walked along the beach with his mouth full of pebbles, forcing himself to speak without stopping, louder and more forcefully than the waves. He wrote speeches that he then recited while running up steep slopes to develop better breathing techniques. He installed a looking glass in his study, allowing him to monitor closely the looks on his face as he declaimed. He would engage in conversations with visitors to his house and gauge how each word or intonation would affect them. Within a year of such dedicated practice, he had completely eliminated his stammer and had transformed himself into a more than adequate orator. He decided to return to law after all. With each new case that he won, his confidence rose to new heights. Understanding the value of practice, he then worked on improving the delivery of his speeches. Slowly, he transformed himself into the supreme orator of ancient Athens. This newfound confidence translated into everything he did. He became a leading political figure, renowned for his fearlessness in the face of any foe. When you take the time to master a simple process and overcome a basic insecurity, you develop certain skills that can be applied to anything. You see instantly the reward that comes from patience, practice, and discipline. You have the sense that you can tackle almost any problem in the same way. You create for yourself a pattern of confidence that will continue to rise. Internalize the rules of the game. As a law student at Howard University in the early 1930s, Thurgood Marshall could contemplate many injustices that blacks experienced in the United States, but the one that burned in him most deeply was the vast inequalities in education. He had toured the South on fact-finding missions for the NAACP and had seen firsthand the abysmal quality of schools set apart for blacks. And he had felt this injustice himself. He had wanted to go to the University of Maryland, near his home. It had an excellent law school. But black students were not admitted there, no matter their academic record. They were directed towards black universities such as Howard, which at the time were inferior. Marshall vowed that someday, in some way, he would take this unjust system apart. Upon graduation from Howard in 1933, he faced a crucial decision for his future. He had been offered a scholarship at Harvard University to study for an advanced law degree. This represented an incredible opportunity. He could carve out for himself a nice position within the academic world and promote his ideas in various journals. It was also the middle of the Depression, and jobs for black people were few and far between. A degree from Harvard would ensure him a prosperous future. But something impelled Marshall in the opposite direction. He decided instead to set up a private practice in Baltimore and learned from the ground up how the justice system worked. At first it seemed a foolish decision. He had little work and his debts were mounting. The few cases he had, he lost, and he could not figure out why. The justice system seemed to have its own rules and codes, to which he had no access. Marshall decided to employ a unique strategy to overcome this. First, he made sure that his legal briefs were masterpieces of research in detail, without any errors or erasures. He made a point of always dressing in the most professional manner and acting with the utmost courtesy, without appearing to bow and scrape. In other words, he gave no one the slightest pretext for judging against him. In this way, he diffused suspicion, began to win a few cases, and gained entree to the world of white lawyers. Now he studied that world closely. He saw the importance of certain connections and friendships, power networks he had not known about before. He recognized that certain judges required certain treatment. He learned to talk the language and fit in socially as best he could. He found out that in most cases, it was best to argue on points of narrow procedure rather than on grand concepts. Knowing how to maneuver within these rules and conventions, he began to win more and more cases. In 1935, he took on the University of Maryland on behalf of a black student who had been denied admission to its law school, and won. From then on, he used his knowledge to take on all forms of segregation in the education system, culminating in 1954 with his greatest triumph of all, arguing before the U.S. Supreme Court the case known as Brown v. Board of Education. The court's decision in his favor effectively ended any basis for educational segregation in the United States. What Marshall, who would later become the first African-American appointed to the Supreme Court, had learned by immersing himself in the white-controlled justice system of his time, is that the social process is just as important as the legal or technical one. This was not something taught in law school, and yet learning it was the key to his ability to function within the system and advance the cause for which he was fighting. Understand, when you enter a group as part of a job or a career, there are all kinds of rules that govern behavior, values of good and bad, power networks that must be respected, patterns to be followed for successful action. If you do not patiently observe and learn them well, you will make all kinds of mistakes without knowing why or how. Think of social and political skills as a craft that you must master as well as any other. In the initial phase of your apprenticeship, you must do as Marshall did and mute your colors. Your goal here is not to impress people with your brilliance, but to learn these conventions from the inside. Watch for telling mistakes that others have made in the group and for which they have paid a price. That will reveal particular taboos within the culture. With a deepening knowledge of these rules, you can begin to maneuver them for your purpose. If you find yourself confronting an unjust and corrupt system, it is much more effective to learn its codes from the inside and discover its vulnerabilities. Knowing how it works, you can take it apart for good. Attune yourself to the details. As a young student artist in late 15th century Italy, Michelangelo had to confront a personal limitation. He had grand concepts of things he wanted to paint and sculpt, but not the requisite skill. He looked at the masterpieces of other artists and wanted his own work to have a similar aura and effect, but he was frustrated at the flatness and conventionality of what he created. He tried an experiment. He began to copy his favorite masterworks, down to the smallest brushstroke. And he discovered that the effect he had so admired was embedded in certain details, the way these artists were able to make figures or landscapes come to life by their intense attention to the fine points. And so began a remarkable apprenticeship to his craft that would last the rest of his life and completely alter his way of thinking. In creating his sculptures, he became obsessed with bone structure, but the books and techniques on the subject seemed woefully inadequate. He started dissecting human corpses, one after another. This gave him a profound feel for human anatomy that he could now reproduce in his work. He developed an interest in texture, how each kind of fabric would fold in its own way. He worked on perfecting his reproduction of clothes. He extended these studies of detail to animals and how they moved. When he was commissioned to do his larger pieces, he avoided that old temptation of beginning with some grand concept. Instead, he looked at the material he was to work with, the space, the individual figures that might comprise it, and from there he would conceive the overall shape and effect. In this intense attention to detail, Michelangelo seemed to have discovered the secret for making his figures come to life in a way that exceeded any other artist of his time. Often when you begin a project of any kind, it is from the wrong end. You tend to think first of what you want to accomplish, imagining the glory and money it will bring you if it succeeds. You then proceed to make this concept come to life. But as you go forward, you often lose patience, because the small steps to get there are not nearly as exciting as the ambitious visions in your head. You must try instead the opposite approach, which can lead to very different results. You have a project you wish to bring to life, but you begin by immersing yourself in the details of the subject or field. You look at the materials you have to work with, the tastes of your target audience, and the latest technical advances in the field. You take pleasure in going deeper and deeper into these fine points. Your research is intense. From this knowledge, you shape the project itself, grounding it in reality rather than in airy concepts in your head. Operating this way helps you slow your mind down and develop patience for detailed work, an essential skill for mastering any craft. Rediscover your natural persistence. This is the dilemma we all face. To accomplish anything worthwhile in life generally takes some time, often in blocks of years. But we are creatures who find it very hard to manage such long periods. We are immersed in the day-to-day. Our emotions fluctuate with each encounter. We have immediate desires we are constantly working to satisfy. In that long period of time that we need to reach a goal, we are assailed by 1,000 distractions and temptations that seem more interesting. We lose sight of our objectives and end up following some detour. This is the source of so many of the failures in our lives. To force yourself past any obstacle or temptation, you must be persistent. As children, we all had this quality because we were single-minded. You must simply rediscover and redevelop this character trait. First, you must understand the role that your energy level plays in mastering a process and bringing something to completion. If you take on added goals or new tasks, your focus will be broken up, and you will never attain what you wanted in the first place. You cannot persist on 2 or 3 paths, so avoid that temptation. Second, try breaking things up into smaller blocks of time. You have a large goal, but there are steps along the way, and steps within the steps. These steps represent months instead of years. Reaching these smaller goals gives you a sense of tangible reward and progress. This will make it easier for you to resist any diversions along the way and fearlessly push ahead. Remember, anything will give way to a sustained, persistent attack on your part. Reversal of perspective. We generally experience boredom as something painful and to be avoided at all costs. From childhood on, we develop the habit of immediately looking for some activity to kill the feeling. But this activity, if repeated often enough, becomes boring as well. And so, for our entire lives, we must search and search for novel amusements. New friends, new trends to latch on to, new forms of entertainment, new religions or causes to believe in. This search might lead us to change our careers and set us on a path of meandering here and there, in search of something to dull the sensation. But in all of these cases, the root of the problem is not boredom itself, but our relationship to it. Try to look at boredom from the opposite perspective, as a call for you to slow yourself down, to stop searching for endless distractions. This might mean forcing yourself to spend time alone, overcoming that childish inability to sit still. When you work through such self-imposed boredom, you will find your mind clicks into gear. New and unexpected thoughts will come to you to fill the void. To feel inspired, you must first experience a moment of emptiness. Use such moments to assess the day that went by, to measure where you are headed. It is a relief to not feel that constant need for outside entertainment. On a higher level of this re-education, you might choose a book to overcome your boredom. But instead of reading being a passive process of diversion, you actively mentally engage the author in an argument or discussion, making the book come to life in your head. At a further point, you take up a side activity, cultural or physical, that requires a repetitive process to master. You discover a calming effect in the repetitive element itself. In this way, boredom becomes your great ally. It helps you to slow things down, develop patience and self-discipline. Through this process, you will be able to withstand the inevitable empty moments of life and convert them into your own private pleasures.